Fox News. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has been ordered by the House Armed Services Committee to explain how the Pentagon plans to extract Americans who were left behind after U.S. forces withdrew. Yesterday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken offered no timeline.
Blinken says most of the remaining Americans are dual nationals who call Afghanistan home. And while he says the vast majority of the 124,000 evacuated were at-risk Afghans, he acknowledges that a majority of SIV applicants did not make it out. This, as reports pour in of the Taliban going door to door to find and punish Afghans who worked with the U.S.
Fox's Griff Jenkins. As Louisiana dries out from Hurricane Ida, most of the lights should be back on in New Orleans by next week. Yesterday, President Biden surveyed catastrophic storm damage in the city of LaPlace.
We're going to make sure we have someone coming through here, going door to door, letting people know what's available to them right now because they can't connect online.
The president is also pledging full federal support in the Northeast, where Ida's remnants dumped record-breaking rain. At least 50 people from Virginia to Connecticut were killed. Fox's Brian Yenis is in Manville, New Jersey.
There have been multiple water rescues throughout the town of Manville, about 30 miles south of New York City. The Millstone River here rose to just over 20 feet, a near record. Flooding begins when waters rise to just 9 feet.
Some areas are still flooded. Another huge spike in new COVID-19 cases in the U.S. More than 300,000 new infections were recorded yesterday by Johns Hopkins. More than 3,900 people died. America's listening to Fox News. Segments of corporate America are coming together following the passage of a new abortion law in Texas. The law bans abortions after a heartbeat is detected. It also gives citizens the right to file civil lawsuits against anyone aiding an abortion, including those who transport women to clinics. That has ride-hailing companies Uber and Lyft pledging to cover the legal fees of any driver who sued. The law has also been criticized by the chief executive of Match Group, which owns the dating site Tinder. The company is creating a fund to help any employee based in Texas who needs to seek an abortion out of state. A lawsuit's been filed in Iowa over the state's ban on COVID-19 mask mandates.
Parents with students with disabilities and disability rights groups are suing Iowa, claiming its law that bans forced masking in schools discriminates against students with disabilities, who they contend are at higher risk for COVID-19. The plaintiffs are asking a judge to block the mask ban signed by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, who advocates for virus vaccines, but who's also been critical of the CDC's universal school masking guidelines, saying it's not grounded in reality or common sense, and that it's not the government's job to order such mandates. Jeff Manasso, Fox News.
A confrontation over COVID-19 mandates leads to an arrest in Arizona.
The father of a student is accused of trespassing at Mesquite Elementary School in Tucson, where school officials say he and two other men, one carrying zip ties, threatened to make a citizen's arrest over COVID protocols, then refused to leave the principal's office. She left instead and called police.
Fox's Lisa Brady. The incident happened after a student missed a field trip because they were told to quarantine after possible exposure to the coronavirus. Pam Huso, Fox News.
On 395 southbound in Arlington, there is a crash. Right lane is blocked at Glebe Road. On the Beltway in Virginia, inner loop and outer loop, you're not going to be hitting your brakes. All lanes are clear. On 66 in Fairfax County, no construction and no crashes, eastbound and westbound. Good ride on 95 in Virginia between the Beltway and Frederick, north and south. In D.C., 295, 395, and 695, including the tunnels and bridges, you're not going to slow down, no construction and no crashes. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and still very comfortable on this Saturday. Great start to Labor Day weekend. High temperatures around the 80-degree mark. Later on tonight, clouds will be on the increase. Lows back in the 60s as we head into your Sunday. Scattered showers will be possible, particularly in the morning north and west of D.C. Otherwise, mostly cloudy skies on Sunday. Highs in the upper 70s. For Labor Day Monday, we're looking at partly cloudy to mostly sunny skies. Should be a great end of the long weekend. High temperatures into the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday morning update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday morning update. It's Labor Day weekend. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houghton and our producer this morning. As you heard at the top of the hour, the House Armed Services Committee adopted an amendment yesterday. It will require the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, to detail various elements of the Pentagon's activities in Afghanistan, including how military officials plan to facilitate the evacuation of American citizens who were left behind. It's a really big story. We're going to cover it from a number of different angles this morning, the whole scenario in Afghanistan and where we stand right now. We're going to get into that. A quick look at some of the headlines concerning Afghanistan. Women stage protest in Taliban-controlled Kabul today. Taliban spokesperson warns U.S. not to interfere with their culture. Opinion in the Philadelphia Inquirer. After Afghanistan failure, what is America prepared to fight for now? And in the New York Post, the Mr. Nice Guy Joe everyone expected is suddenly mean Mr. Biden. Why is he saying that? Well, if you've seen the president this week, a number of the media people were referring to the president as defiant. That's not a good word when the media starts calling you defiant. Remember when they used that on President Trump? Yes, defiant was the word this week, and part of the reason is just so many of the things that President Biden said. Here's a short one, but it'll just give you one sense, number one, of the defiance, and number two, of the misrepresentation, and we can do it all in 7 seconds.
Couldn't this have been done in a more orderly manner? I respectfully disagree.
Play that one more time, because it's so short, but it is so succinct.
Couldn't this have been done in a more orderly manner? I respectfully disagree.
Well, I think a lot of people respectfully disagree with you. Now, Lawrence O'Donnell, big cheerleader for the administration over at MSNBC, he bought it. He drank the Kool-Aid. Here's what he had to say.
President Biden left a marker for history today. President Biden delivered the most accurate and most honest speech by an American president about Afghanistan.
That's Lawrence O'Donnell at MSNBC. In contrast, Peter Meyer is on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He's a Republican. He is a veteran of Afghanistan. Here's how he characterizes the president's address this week, in contrast to Lawrence O'Donnell.
Well, we had many layers of lies, right? You obviously most recently have the president who is lying about any number of things, from relationship between the Haqqani network and the Taliban to whether or not there is Al-Qaeda that's present in Afghanistan, to the spokesperson saying that Americans are not stranded, that they can get to the airport and that the Taliban aren't harassing them, all of which are false. The broader issue, though, is just how long the lies have been going on in terms of the progress of the war, even up until recently, with the President Biden trying to tell former Afghan President Ghani to lie about the status of those forces to try to boost up his troop morale. So this has just been a ongoing deception for far too long.
Well, that's a somewhat more accurate appraisal of, I think, the situation as it stands now. Now, part of the concern I think a lot of Americans have, and a lot of people on the Hill, both Democrats and Republican, is kind of the status of this effort to get those who are left in Afghanistan out. Now, there's a question mark as to how many Americans are there. The president and many members of the administration have been scolding all week, saying, well, we sent them 19 emails and we're trying to call them. Doesn't help them get out after the deadline that the president put on August 31st. Why that was not extended, I will never understand. But here's just an example from the Undersecretary of State, Victoria Nuland, and Ned Price is the State Department spokesman. And if you listen to them trying to kind of explain the situation, you might understand why people are a little concerned.
We are looking at all possible options, air routes, land routes. to continue to find ways for them to help evacuate and to support them in that. We're trying to ascertain who precisely still wants to leave, who their dependent family members are, what routes may or may not feel comfortable to them.
Half the world's countries, all of the most important stakeholders have signed on to the idea that the Taliban must uphold their commitments of safe passage.
Are you hearing any real leverage in there? A bunch of countries signed on, and let's hope they go with the safe passage idea. I have a clip here of Jen Psaki. It's like 2 minutes, and I'm not going to play the full 2 minutes, but just give you a little sample of how she's trying to explain the leverage.
Well, first I would say I would point you to the remarks that the Secretary of State provided last night, but let me give you some highlights of that. We have enormous leverage over the Taliban, including access to the global marketplace. That's not a small it's not a small piece of leverage. And in order to gain access to the global marketplace, we're going to be watching closely, as will the global community. I would note that yesterday the UN Security Council also signed passed a resolution that made clear to what the expectation is in terms of safe travel. An evacuation or departure, I should say, of individuals who want to leave Afghanistan. And nearly half of the countries in the world have also signed on a statement making clear that is the expectation. That's
okay,
the diplomatic
enough,
side.
Enough of this. They've signed on to a statement saying that's the expectation. That's real leverage. Yeah, that's boots on the ground. That's an Air Force base within range of being able to take out Taliban installations if they don't cooperate. So that's why everybody's a little upset, because this whole notion of leverage, a little on the weak side. Now, there were some eyebrows raised this week by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley. He was asked about the Taliban. And at the end of this, he's asked about ISIS-K. And this one kind of caused a stir.
I can tell you from personal experience that this is a ruthless group from the past. And whether or not they change remains to be seen. And as far as our dealings with them at that airfield, in war, you do what you must in order to reduce risk to mission and force, not what you necessarily want to do.
Any possibility of coordination against ISIS-K with them?
It's possible.
It's possible. Just the way he said it, you could tell he was irritated, and a lot of people picked up on that. And that's just an example of why there is so much concern. And we've been following this very closely. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to check in with Al BD in the WMAL Traffic Center. And we've got more on Afghanistan. We've got more on what's going on Capitol Hill, too. And stay with us on the Saturday Morning Update. Here's Al BD.
On the Maryland side of the Beltway, from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, bridge to bridge, on the inner loop and outer loop, all lanes are at the posted speed limit. No construction and no crashes to slow you down. Traveling between the two beltways on the BW Parkway and on 95, no delays northbound or southbound. In Prince George's County on Route 50, between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, eastbound lanes are at speed, and the same thing on the westbound side. At the Bay Bridge, you got two lanes headed east and three lanes coming west. And on 270 in Montgomery County, no delays between the Beltway and Frederick. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and still very comfortable on this Saturday. Great start to Labor Day weekend. High temperatures around the 80-degree mark. Later on tonight, clouds will be on the increase. Lows back in the 60s. As we head into your Sunday, scattered showers will be possible, particularly in the morning north and west of D.C. Otherwise, mostly cloudy skies on Sunday. Highs in the upper 70s. For Labor Day Monday, we're looking at partly cloudy to mostly sunny skies. Should be a great end of the long weekend. High temperatures into the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
It is a chilly 59 degrees in the nation's capital, 619, the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is a Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler, and a lot of things going on Capitol Hill that are of note, and in particular, Senator Joe Manchin. He's been sort of right there with Kristen Sinema from Arizona, trying to kind of hold the very progressive Democrats in line. And Manchin on Friday demanding a strategic pause in action on President Biden's economic agenda. And that potentially really imperils the $3.5 trillion tax and spending package the Democratic leaders have been planning to push through the Congress this fall. Now, he wrote an op-ed piece, and he said, by placing a strategic pause on this budgetary proposal, by significantly reducing the size of any possible reconciliation bill to only what America can afford and needs to spend, we can and we will build a better and stronger nation for all our families. Well, of course, that upset a number of Democrats. He's the target now of people like AOC and those on the progressive side of the aisle. So Joe Manchin is helping to put the brakes on that $3.5 trillion spending package. Now, the polls. Remember how everybody made such a big deal of the polls for Donald Trump? Well, Washington Post headline, "The Middle Turns on Biden." They go on to say the Afghanistan withdrawal has contributed to a drop in Biden's overall approval rating, which for the first time in his presidency is net negative. The poll finds while 51% disapprove, only 44% say they approve of how he is handling the job. In late June, the numbers were almost the opposite. The poll shows that 57% of independents now disapprove of his performance, compared with 43% in late June. Asked more generally whether they approve or disapprove of Biden's overall handling of the situation in Afghanistan, 60% say they disapprove, compared with 30% who approve. That's a real problem for the president, a real problem for the Democrats, as they're going to be heading into 2022. So the White House obviously trying to change the narrative this week, sending the president to Louisiana yesterday. And he's been attacking the Texas abortion bill, something else to try and change the subject. Surprisingly, even the Huffington Post and the Los Angeles Times ran articles this week on the weaponry that we have left in Afghanistan. And Pentagon says, well, it's not going to be used to harm the U.S. And they made a big deal that they were able to neutralize the weapons and aircraft left at the airport. But it's a whole country full of weapons. And we're going to talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer about that this morning, get his read on it. Some of the other angles on Afghanistan with Tony. We'll talk with KT McFarland, of course, former Deputy National Security Advisor. We'll get her very latest read on how the administration is handling this and where we go forward from here. John Gizzi will join us. He was at the White House every day of the week. We'll get his read from the White House briefing room. And also we'll talk with John about the impact of Joe Manchin's comments and where the entire infrastructure package may go next. And also, we're going to be talking with Jim Trusty, our legal advisor, and we'll get into the Texas abortion bill. It's already made it to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court acting on some elements on Friday. So we'll get the very latest from Jim Trusty, trying to put that into layman's terms for us. Jennifer Harper joining us this morning, and she's got some very interesting poll numbers for us. Also on the way, we will talk to a very special military spouse, a very interesting conversation coming up, and it is all on the way. Do stay with us. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. 6:28 Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I mentioned the LA Times and the Huffington Post being somewhat honest with us about the weaponry left in Afghanistan, and it has been an interesting turn of events in watching some of the traditional liberal and progressive media outlets actually being critical of the president and the Afghanistan situation. The New York Daily News is the more liberal of the rags in New York, and of course the New York Post is the more conservative, and this one is for them, the more liberal New York Daily News. Here's the headline, Biden's Afghanistan baloney, such a success, let us count the ways. And they go on to say, never mind what your lying eyes just witnessed. President Biden told the world in America the end of the war in Afghanistan was a historic success. the withdrawal that he promised not long ago would be safe and orderly, that was nothing but. Couldn't have gone any other way. The only alternative to this horribly bungled pullout was escalation, another year or five or ten of war, dooming the American military to even more perilous flighting. In other words, if you find yourself critiquing the frenzied and chaotic exit, wishing there had been some semblance of good planning, you may as well be rooting for the death of more American troops. And they went on to say a lot more about the Afghanistan exit. Now, there's one other one that I found kind of interesting. We all recall the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He wrote an op-ed. The decision to withdraw from Afghanistan in this way was driven not by grand strategy, but by politics. We didn't need to do it. We did it in obedience to an imbecilic political slogan about ending the forever wars, as if our engagement in 2021 was remotely comparable to our commitment 20 or even 10 years ago. And in circumstances in which troop numbers had declined to a minimum and no Allied soldier had lost their life in combat in 18 months. That criticism from the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. It is 6:30. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Lots to cover. Stay with us. Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the Beltway in Virginia, I'm checking out the traffic cameras, and I'm not seeing any delays on the inner loop or on the outer loop. On 66 in Fairfax County, eastbound lanes and the westbound lanes are at the posted speed limit. On 95, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, northbound and southbound, no delays there. And if you're headed to the airports, BWI, National, or Dulles, the roads leading to the terminals are clear of any delays. You should be able to hit your gate on time. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and still very comfortable on this Saturday. Great start to Labor Day weekend. High temperatures around the 80-degree mark. Later on tonight, clouds will be on the increase. Lows back in the 60s. As we head into your Sunday, scattered showers will be possible, particularly in the morning north and west of D.C. Otherwise, mostly cloudy skies on Sunday. Highs in the upper 70s. For Labor Day Monday, we're looking at partly cloudy to mostly sunny skies. Should be a great end of the long weekend. High temperatures into the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
59 degrees in the nation's capital, 634 on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update. It is Labor Day weekend. I'm Rick Fowler. It is great to have you with us, and it is great to have Jennifer Harper join us. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and she doesn't take Labor Day off. How are you?
No, I don't, actually. I'm laboring on Labor Day, so... Happy holiday, everybody.
Well, when the going gets tough, the tough go on vacation. Where is El Presidente Biden this weekend?
Well, you know, he can't go too many places without some very eagle-eyed Republicans who are watching all of this going on. And I have a little statement here from the Republican National Committee, and this is what they had to say. Joe Biden is headed back on vacation. When Kabul fell, he was on vacation. As the chaotic evacuation began, he slowly came back to the White House and then quickly went on another vacation. And now, after he broke his promise and stranded hundreds of Americans in Afghanistan, he is going back home for yet another vacation. This is Biden's version of fiddling as Rome burns. Anyway, that's coming from the Republican National Committee, and they are citing an Associated Press report that said that, indeed, Mr. Biden was headed out of town. This is according to the Federal Aviation Administration. And, you know, just for a little context, there's some statistics out there already compiled by Mark Noller. A lot of people know who he is. He's a former CBS White House correspondent, just a brilliant guy. He compiles statistics about all sorts of presidential comings and goings. Anyway, he reveals that by mid-August, Mr. Biden had spent 14 weekends at his Delaware home, 9 weekends at Camp David, and a mere 6 weekends at the White House.
Well, maybe the more he's on vacation, the less damage he can do at the White House. Let us turn to how Americans are feeling about the president and where we're headed.
Well, the news is not so good. As usual, on a Saturday morning, I come at you with numbers, but this is a short poll, everybody, so don't worry too much. This is a Politico Morning Consult poll of close to 2,000 registered U.S. voters conducted August 28 through 30, very, very up to the moment here. And they have discovered that 61% of registered U.S. voters agree that things in this country have pretty seriously gotten off on the wrong track. That's 6 out of 10 Americans. Of course, there's a kind of a giant partisan divide there. 88% of Republicans agree with that, along with 30% of Democrats. Interestingly enough, 66% of women and 55% of men also agree with that. And let's move down to the 39% overall that agree that things in this country are going in the right direction. That's around a third. But anyway, here's your partisan divide for the morning. 12% of Republicans think that things are going okay, along with 70% of Democrats. Again, that's a Politico Morning Consult poll released this week.
So the president went to Louisiana on Friday for that photo op. The White House doing everything they can to put Afghanistan and the remaining Americans, journalists, and the Afghans who helped us that want to get out in the rearview mirror. What is the latest you have on the journalists who are still stranded in Afghanistan?
Well, this is a very interesting turn of events here because the journalists that we're talking about are the journalists who are from Afghanistan and other nations who are loyal to the United States. And they have been left behind following the exodus of our troops and support teams and all sorts of folks. And these are journalists that have worked under the umbrella of the U.S. Agency for Global Media. They are the independent federal agency that oversees the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and some other really fantastic news organizations. And Representative Michael McCaul, he's a Texas Republican, he is very angry about this. Here's a statement that he said this week. It is absolutely disgraceful that the U.S. State Department claimed they evacuated their local employees when in reality they abandoned hundreds of journalists and their families. Again, they're referring to folks that might have worked for the Voice of America and other news organizations. And Mr. McCaul, he estimated that some 500 of these journalists plus their families still remain in Afghanistan and that many were told they're going to be evacuated by the Biden administration. And they were not. So, again, here's another pertinent quote. This is coming from Yolanda Lopez. She's actually the acting director of the Voice of America. This is what she told USA Today. We are incredibly disappointed that our efforts over the past few weeks to get our colleagues safe passage out of Afghanistan have been unsuccessful. We have been working day and night pursuing every available option only to hit countless obstacles and roadblocks. And this story was picked up by a lot of the press, Fox News, USA Today, New York Post, The Wrap, The Guardian, lots more. And one more quote from someone who's in the middle of all that, that would be Jamie Fly. He is the Radio Free Europe president. Here's what he told The Washington Post. You would have expected that the U.S. government, which helped create the space for journalism and civil society in Afghanistan over the last 20 years, would have tried to do more over the last several weeks to assist journalists who made a decision that it was best for them to leave the country. So tough situation over there for those folks, and we're hoping for the best for them.
Fall is often a good time for state fairs around the country. And what is the fair at these state fairs?
That's a good way to put it. I'm often followed all the food that they serve out on the midways and in the carnivals at the state fairs. And some of the state fairs are not happening this year, but certainly one of the largest one is, Rick. That's the Texas State Fair, and that's opening September the 24th. And I love finding out what their culinary delights are every year because quite often all these fairs change their foods around. And here's just a brief list of some of the Midway Fair and Carnival Fair that you can get at the Texas State Fair coming up. They have deep-fried country shrimp grits, deep-fried seafood gumbo balls, lobster corn dog, deep-fried Ritz crackers, deep-fried toffee, duck bacon dumplings, crawfish, etouffee stuffed turkey legs, bacon jam corn bombs, southern fried lemon icebox pie balls, and frozen ranch water, Rick. That is a tequila-based cocktail coming out of the Texas State Fair. And they did they had a big competition among all the concessionaires that come out for some of the best food of all. And the deep-fried seafood gumbo balls won the Best Taste Award in both the savory and creative categories. And if you're wondering what the heck those are, here's what the Texas State Fair says they are. Using a family recipe that has been handed down four generations, the base is dark, rich, and savory roux that represents the true essence of New Orleans. The balls are then loaded with Gulf Coast shrimp, stewed chicken, blue crab meat, and andouille sausage. The balls are then rolled in our saltine cracker and breadcrumb batter, then fried, creating an explosion of flavor. The balls are served with a side of dark gumbo roux sauce for your dipping pleasure and topped with chicken fried okra spears. The dish will be served with a small bottle of hot sauce and a package of saltine crackers. So that's what the judges said about the it's the deep fried seafood gumbo balls. There you go.
Sounds good to me. Jennifer Harper inside the Beltway, The Washington Times. Follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you. 6:43 Saturday morning update. We're going to talk with Jim Trustee next, but first, Al BD is in the WML Traffic Center this morning.
In D.C., 295, 395, 695, plus the tunnels and bridges, there isn't any construction and no crashes to slow you down. Now on to the Maryland side of the Beltway, from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, bridge to bridge, inner loop and outer loop are at speed. Now, if you're traveling between the two beltways on the BW Parkway and on 95, no delays northbound or southbound. On Route 50 in Prince George's County, it's clear between the beltway and the Bay Bridge, east and west. And at the Bay Bridge, two lanes are headed east and three lanes are now coming west. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy and still very comfortable on this Saturday. Great start to Labor Day weekend. High temperatures around the 80-degree mark. Later on tonight, clouds will be on the increase. Lows back in the 60s as we head into your Sunday. Scattered showers will be possible, particularly in the morning north and west of D.C. Otherwise, mostly cloudy skies on Sunday. Highs in the upper 70s. For Labor Day Monday, we're looking at partly cloudy to mostly sunny skies. Should be a great end of the long weekend. High temperatures into the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
59 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:44, the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
History heard here on Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It's the Saturday morning update. It's Labor Day weekend. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trustee working with us this morning. He is an attorney at IFRA Law here in Washington. He is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, great to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
One of the next big legal fights I guess we'll see in this country is regarding the new Texas abortion law. And the way the New York Times describes it, the law prohibits abortions before many women even know they're pregnant. It will be hard to challenge in the courts. It went into effect on Wednesday, despite the 1973 Supreme Court decision that established a constitutional right to the procedure. So, Jim, sounds like a lot of legal intricacies here.
Rick, Texas passed a very interesting law. It is amending a prior law they had in the books about abortion long before Roe versus Wade. But what they're doing is they're creating a statutory tort, a lawsuit for private citizens, but not for the government, to try to stop abortions from occurring when the fetus has a heartbeat. And that goes a little bit to the controversy that the New York Times is dredging up, which is it's not even 100% clear when a fetus forms a heart. Texas would say it's maybe in the neighborhood of 6 weeks. Other people say it's about 8 weeks. But either way, it's early into the pregnancy, or at least relatively early into the pregnancy. And now we've had a case come directly to the Supreme Court requesting a preliminary injunction to stop that law from taking effect.
So, Jim, the law was passed on Wednesday, but what? It's already had some Supreme Court activity by Friday?
Yeah, that's a super fast track and a very unusual one. The case went directly to the Supreme Court as a request for a preliminary injunction. It's not yet the constitutionality of the Texas law. You know, the big question that the New York Times and everyone else is wondering about is what are they going to do with Roe versus Wade, and what do they think about the right to abort and the regulations of abortion? But really all that was resolved this week was a very thorny question of standing, you know, whether or not the parties that have filed suit can actually eventually succeed on the merits. In other words, in our courts, we put up these procedural burdens, such as standing and mootness and ripeness, because we want actual controversies to be resolved, not hypothetical questions. And here, this is a very interesting kind of procedural question in that the government hasn't made it a crime in Texas. This is purely a private tort. And so does anyone have the ability to challenge it before the enforcement has begun when they haven't been subjected to it? So, again, for legal nerds like myself, that's kind of a very interesting, thorny question. For others, it sounds like dreck. But the bottom line is the majority of the Supreme Court said we can't say the plaintiffs are likely to succeed on the merits, on the constitutional question, because we're not sure they really have standing at this point. And that's a very important point for equitable relief, for a preliminary injunction, as we've talked about in other contexts, right? You have to be able to show the court that you're asking for something extraordinary because you're probably going to win later. And Justice Roberts, Stevens, Sotomayor, and Kagan all basically said, yeah, you might be right, but this is so important that we want to maintain status quo until we can decide the bigger issue. So right now, the ruling that came out of the Supreme Court is all about process and not about substance. It has nothing to do directly with whether they're going to uphold Roe versus Wade, modify it, strike down this Texas law. All of that is left for another day.
So there is a legal precedent established by Roe versus Wade. How does that affect where this goes?
Yeah, that's a perfect question. That really is the bigger issue at play here, is this concept of precedent, or what they call stare decisis. And basically, as a criminal justice system and even civil law, we like to have predictability. We like to have the law settled. And sometimes that means the Supreme Court, like they did in Roe versus Wade, weighing in and saying, this is the law of the land. And if the Supremes get it right, then that's the law of the land and everybody's fine with it. But there's times where the Supreme Court in history gets things wrong. Perfect example would be like Plessy versus Ferguson, where African Americans were treated as less than whole when it came to white America, or the Japanese internment camp decision being upheld. And these are moments where the Supreme Court, the modern Supreme Court, looks back and says, you know, it's good to not always follow precedent. Sometimes we realize we got it wrong. And so a lot of folks on this case will say that they think that the Supreme Court got it wrong with Roe versus Wade, that they carved out a privacy right, in this case for abortion, that really wasn't in the text of the Constitution. And what's interesting to me, Rick, is you see totally unrelated opinions from the Supreme Court, nothing to do with abortion, where the justices are going out of their way to put into their opinions their feelings about precedent, because they're teeing up the fight. They want to be consistent. They want to say, look how I've always thought that, you know, precedential value is important, or look how, you know, I as a justice think that we need to change the law from time to time. And so you can read an opinion about firearms or about voting or about almost anything under the sun, and you'll see opinions that talk about this big notion of precedent. And that's what we're going to find out at some point, is whether Roe versus Wade is treated as inviolate, you know, where you cannot change it, or whether they're going to say, as a majority, that something was so fundamentally flawed with that opinion that it's time to change it. I think Justice Roberts is the type of personality, at least what we've seen so far as a Chief Justice, that he doesn't want the court to look too conservative politically. He doesn't want them to look too aggressive. And so I think there's a possibility that he is desperately hoping to either avoid the issue of Roe versus Wade, or maybe more realistically, come up with a bit of a compromise that maybe nobody loves, but everybody can tolerate.
Jim, this is starting to sound like a House or Senate committee negotiation. Tell us a little bit about the process of negotiation at the Supreme Court and how that might play out with Chief Justice Roberts.
There's 9 very intelligent, very passionate advocates for their position. So they'll have a lot of conversation on this one. But I do think there's a possibility of Roberts engineering a compromise that at least works on some levels. It would keep Roe versus Wade as precedent, but it would satisfy the pro-life crowd at least a little bit. And here's what I'm saying. Roe versus Wade was entirely built upon the idea of balancing the state's interest with the individual's freedom. And in that balance, they look mightily to the notion of when a fetus is viable. And I think what we've seen over the last 50 years from technology is that fetuses are viable at an earlier stage in the pregnancy than they were in the 1970s. So you could allow more regulation by the state because of that early viability, but still keep the general framework of Roe versus Wade alive. Now, again, it's going to be controversial no matter what they come up with, but there is room to uphold the case but still chip away at the availability of abortion.
Jim, we've gotten into a good legal discussion, but one simple question. What would happen if Roe versus Wade were overturned?
That's a good question. I think a lot of people actually forget what the impact would be. It does not mean abortion is outlawed across the board. What it does is it returns that decision, that ruling, to all of the states. So each state gets to make their own decision on how they want to approach the topic of abortion. There's a lot of conservative states that have already teed up restrictions or regulations on abortion in case Roe is overturned. Presumably liberal states would be able to allow abortions to continue as they are. So it doesn't change everything on a dime. It just leaves it to the states, where a lot of people would argue the right to monitor this type of activity should have been in the first place.
Jim, we see a lot on the Fox News channel, but you're going to be on Court TV with something new.
Yeah, Court TV has a program in the afternoons. For me, it's going to be 4 to 6 on Thursday, where they watch televised trials and they have trial attorneys of varying levels of experience talk about the trials, about what they're seeing, the advocacy, the issues, the cross-examination. So it's a very instantaneous or spontaneous approach to watching trials, and it's doing what lawyers love doing, which is critiquing other lawyers. But it should be kind of fun, and I'll be doing that for the first time this Thursday afternoon.
How fun to critique other lawyers. Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. Have a great Labor Day.
And you too. 6:53 Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. And with the recent attack on our service members at Kabul Airport, we're reminded of the sacrifice of our members of the military and their families. Paulette Fryer will be honored as the 2021 Armed Forces Insurance Military Spouse of the Year. Paulette was chosen from nominations of close to 1,000 military spouses from all branches of the military. Paulette joins us this morning. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. It is my pleasure to be here today.
When I was reading about it, you were quoted as saying that you have a passion for helping ensure that no military spouse feels alone. And tell us a little bit about some of the work that you've done.
Yes, I'd be happy to. One passion I have is working with MOPS International, which is Mothers of Preschoolers. They have a military division, and I have been a mentor in that program for the past 5 years. Since I became an empty nester and had the time, I wanted to be able to give back to that next generation of military spouses. And I just feel it's really important to have people that make themselves available to our young military spouses that may be going through deployment, moving to a new area, all these things for the first time. And I just love being able to kind of be a shoulder for them to cry on, be there to help out, answer questions. We don't have our natural networks available to us locally. We don't have our mom, our aunt, our best friends when we're navigating having babies with a husband deployed and that sort of thing. And I just feel like it's very important to have experienced military spouses to be there to kind of help guide them through those times. So that's something I'm really passionate about. And then I've worked with numerous military spouse groups for my branch specific within the Coast Guard. I have served on many boards, as well as multi-branch, all-rank spouse groups in different areas that we have been assigned. And regardless of age, I like to make myself available to volunteer with these groups to make sure that when someone's coming into a new area, they have relationships, they have support, they have connections. I have found in my experience as a military spouse that I am quite an extrovert, and I like to use those talents to put myself out there when it may be needed to help people get involved in a program or be a part of things, that I can reach out and bring them along and maybe help them feel comfortable if it's a new experience for them.
For those of us that are not in the military, we can guess, but we really don't have any experience understanding what military spouses go through on a daily basis. Whether it is a spouse who is deployed domestically, or if it's a family whose spouse is overseas in an area that could lead either to a terror attack or actual combat at any time. Try and give us a sense of what that's like for us who are not in the military.
Well, I will tell you, I am so very proud of our men and women in uniform, and our service members step up to do the impossible regularly. And I'm very proud of the families and spouses supporting them. As a military spouse, we know there are those stresses and pressures, but we choose to focus on the positives as much as we can. And I like to focus on that when I am supporting a young military spouse. My goal and my motto is, together we are stronger. So if I can gather military spouses and we can provide connection and support that way, and we're not feeling alone, it helps us tackle all those things a lot better.
And your husband is not the only member of the family that's in the service.
My husband, Troy, has been active duty in the United States Coast Guard for 32 years, and we also have a son serving in the Air Force.
Well, we certainly want to thank your family for your service to our country. Thank you.
Appreciate that very much.
What resources would you recommend to a military spouse that might be listening this morning?
If you are a military spouse that is seeking to find more relationships, find some more support, or even get involved to give back to our military community, I definitely recommend in any installation that you are in, you will be able to find a spouse group in your installation. Look it up. You can find it online or Facebook pretty easily. And if you are a young mom and you are needing some support, MOPS International, www.mops.org, you can go and find a military installation that has a MOPS group available to you through that website.
And that's MOPS.org. Paulette Fryer, 2021 Armed Forces Insurance Military Spouse of the Year. Congratulations on the award, and I know you accept that on behalf of all of the military spouses. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Rick. It is my extreme pleasure to be able to represent military spouses across our country.
Thank you again. Hey, we got the 7 o'clock news coming up. Then we are back with John Gizzi, Gordon Chang, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station.